Okay, members, we will call the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission meeting to order. Thank you all for being here. And the first order of business, members, in your packets, we have minutes and kind of general commission business from the first meeting. And so I would just reference you to that. And first, we will move the minutes. Do I have somebody who wants to move the minutes? Representative Dean moves the minutes from our first meeting on July 28th. Are there any changes that anyone has or any comments to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Next, members, I just want to also reference to your attention in your packet, is a schedule of upcoming meetings. All meetings will be from 10 to 12 and will most likely be right here in the state office building, most likely here in room 10 or room 200, but that will certainly be forthcoming as those meetings come up. So if you just want to reference that meeting schedule for scheduling purposes. And then the next thing we just want to go over is review the draft of the 2015 work plan. And I'm going to go to Mr. Schoenbaum from the Department of Health to briefly walk us through that. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. If you'd pull out this table in your packets, now that we have a meeting schedule, I was going to say for the summer, but for the fall, I guess it is. What you have before you is a beginning draft that attempts to capture the discussion we had last meeting about the topics you were interested in looking at as a commission this year, lays them out over the next few meetings. The co-chairs met and did express an interest in producing some kind of a set of recommendations document by the time the commission wraps up this interim, so there is time in the schedule to discuss that, take a look at a draft, and at your last meeting take action on recommendations. Those of you that were on the commission last year found, this is work plan can be fluid, is fluid, and a work in progress. As interests change, as new ideas come up, I think we do have some space over the course of the fall to move things around, add additional topics. I think feel free to keep doing that, and we'll continue to try and capture those interests and build them in to the schedule as we go along. Madam Chair, if members have any first reactions, I think as staff we'd certainly be interested in those this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. And members, maybe what we'll do is, as you kind of look at the draft work plan, if you or throughout the meeting today have any comments, things that you'd like to see added to that, things that you think were left out, we could just take a minute for that at the end for comments. And, of course, the department and Senator Klass and I are available at any time via email or conversation if there's something. This is an ongoing dialogue. But if you just glance at this initial work plan, and we'll take some comments on that at the end as members have a chance to take a look and give it some thought. Anything else, Mr. Schoenbaum, on the draft work plan?
No. As I said, if comparing the notes from last meeting and as they're reflected both, in our written notes and in the minutes, I hope everything that you expect to see is there. If any of that from last time is missing, by all means, let me know. And I think that's a great idea to just kind of revisit it later this morning.
Okay, that will work. Thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum. And members, as you can see, both from the draft work plan and the agenda that's in front of you today, we're going to have a discussion around the issue of preceptors and the rural health care provider tax credits and try to get our heads around some of the challenges that are facing training the workforce and equipping the workforce when it comes to the preceptor issues. And so that is going to be a lot of what our conversation centers around today. And so with that, we'll move into a discussion about the health provider tax credits. Mr. Schoenbaum, I don't know if you want to start that off and tee us up. And then we also have Nina Manzies here to talk to us about what that tax credit looks like. Mr. Schoenbaum.
I will get us started, Madam Chair. As we discussed last meeting, reviewing your report and recommendations from last year, you recommended that the legislature consider a tax credit for preceptors similar to that that exists in the state of Georgia. There was legislation on that subject, which we'll review shortly. The legislation was not enacted. That provision was not enacted. You said you'd like to revisit that subject, so that's what we'll do this morning. Two brief PowerPoint presentations. The first one, if Nina Manzi from House Research will join me at the front. And you also have copies of this. Madam Chair, when we were discussing this part of the agenda, you pointed me at Ms. Manzi. That was a great suggestion, and please, she can get us started with an overview this morning.
Welcome, and thank you for taking the time, Ms. Manzi, to be here and just understanding there's some members of the commission that have maybe served on a tax committee before, but some certainly keep their head in healthcare most of the time, and there's a whole different language a lot of times when it comes to tax policies and how these work. So we thought it would be beneficial to have our one of our House researchers on tax policy who is very good at explaining these things to come and just kind of give us an understanding of what this deduction looks like. So welcome. Thank you for being here, and we appreciate the presentation you prepared.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. I work, as Chair Mack indicated, in the tax area, mostly income tax. What I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about tax deductions and credits and describe how those affect a person's tax liability, give a very big picture view of what we already have in Minnesota's income tax, and then talk just a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of tax expenditures or tax benefits compared with direct spending programs. So first of all, a tax deduction, the way the income tax works is that you figure out what your taxable income is, and that starts with most of your income, your gross income, and then you're allowed deductions at the federal level and personal independent exemptions, which flow through to the state level. And then the state allows additional deductions from taxable income. So a deduction is an amount that you subtract from taxable income before applying the tax rates in order to figure out what your tax liability is for the year. It's reducing the amount of income that's subject to tax. The tax benefit of a deduction will depend on what the taxpayer's income is, because Minnesota, as most of you probably know, has four income tax rates. The lowest one is 5.35%, and the highest is 9.85%. So if you reduce the income of someone who's very high income by $10,000, like the Georgia tax deduction is, then the tax benefit of that will be 9.85% of that $10,000, or $985. If, in contrast, you reduce the taxable income of someone who's lower income by $10,000, the tax benefit to that person will be less. If it's someone who is in the lowest bracket, it would be $535 in contrast to the $985. Now, this is something to consider when you're thinking about if you want to propose a tax benefit for these health care preceptors. They generally are going to be probably higher income rather than lower income people. Need to keep in mind that with deductions and exemptions, your gross income has to be, you know, you have to have quite a bit of it before you even start having any taxable income. For tax year 2015, you don't have any state tax liability if you're a married couple with two dependents until your gross income is greater than $28,600. So that's the value of the standard deduction plus the exemptions. Now, the state that you're looking at, that Mr. Schoenbaum's going to be talking about their deduction a little bit, is the state of Georgia. Georgia, like many other states, has an income tax that's relatively flat. They do have six rates, ranging from 1% to 6%, but a taxpayer reaches the top rate of 6% for a married couple when their taxable income reaches just $10,000. So almost everyone in Georgia with income tax liability is going to be at that top rate, which means that a $10,000 deduction is going to be worth the same tax benefit to most everyone who's getting it in Georgia, which would be 6% of the $10,000, or $600. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind, that our tax system is quite a bit different. We have a higher rate at the top of 9.85%, but it takes effect at a much higher income. It starts in tax year 15 at around 260-something of income for a married couple filing jointly, which is much higher than Georgia's top rate starting at $10,000 of taxable income. Now, the other kind of tax benefit that Mark will be talking about for some other states are tax credits. And a tax credit is something that's applied directly against your tax liability. So with a tax deduction, you're subtracting it from your income, and then you apply the rates to that income and figure out what your tax liability is. If you're eligible for a tax credit, you get to subtract that credit directly from your liability. So a tax credit is worth the same to everybody who's eligible for it, because it offsets their liability equally regardless of what bracket they're in. A non-refundable credit can only be used to reduce your liability to zero, and then if you have any credit beyond that amount, it just sort of is forfeited unless there's a carry-forward mechanism provided. A refundable credit, of which we offer several, mostly for low-income filers in Minnesota, if you have a refundable credit and your tax liability is going to be reduced below zero by your credit, then the excess of it is paid to you as a refund. So it becomes a way for the state to provide transfer payments to lower income filers. In 2015, Minnesota has three deductions that are required by federal law. The federal law prohibits us from taxing some kinds of income. We have three deductions that are required to provide consistency with ways in which we've deviated from federal taxable income in past years. And then we have nine deductions that are simply things that the state has decided they want to offer a tax preference for. The largest of our deductions that affects the most filers is the deduction for K-12 education expenses. People can deduct up to $2,500 for children in secondary education, so grades 7 through 12, and $1,625 of expenses for children in grades K through 6. This was claimed by 216,000 filers. I think that's in tax year 14. And then the tax reduction to the state is $18.6 million. And those estimates are from the Department of Revenue's most recent tax expenditure budget, which is a big report they compile every 2 years that catalogs all of the tax preferences for all of Minnesota's major taxes. The smallest of our tax deductions, there are two of them that are very small, sort of tied for the bottom of list. One is for organ donation expenses, and the other is for gain on the disposition of farm property by taxpayers who are insolvent. The organ donation expense deduction is up to $10,000 for lost wages of a person who decides to donate an organ and has to take time off of work or might have travel expenses to the place where the donation occurs. The farm property deduction is for people who have a gain when they're forced to sell their property because they're insolvent or bankrupt. And ordinarily, under the income tax, you would have to report that gain, and it could be substantial, and then you would have to pay income tax on it. We allow that to be deducted so that people who are already in a difficult situation aren't having to pay tax on it. Each of those deductions is claimed by a small number of taxpayers and is estimated to have a state revenue income impact of less than $50,000 a year. So those ones aren't going to a lot of people. I'm sorry, I should have said at the beginning that if any of you have any questions as I go, please, you know, feel free to ask them because it's a relatively short presentation and we can just do them as we go. Moving on to tax credits, Minnesota currently allows 5 non-refundable tax credits and 9 refundable tax credits. Of the refundable tax credits, 3 of them are targeted to lower-income filers. 5 of them are targeted to business or economic development. That's things like the Angel Investment Credit and the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit. And then we also have a credit for people who serve in the military in combat zones, which is administered separately from the income tax, and it's really more like a bonus, like a rolling bonus that happens each year, where if you served in a combat zone during that year, you can apply and simply receive a payment for this credit from the Department of Revenue. The largest of the tax credits is the Working Family Credit, which is the state companion to the Federal Earned Income Credit. This credit was claimed by over 300,000 filers a year, and it's over $200 million a year currently. It provides a wage supplement. You only get it if you have earnings. It equals a percentage of your earnings, and then it phases out when your income increases above a certain level. The smallest of our credits is a new credit, which I think maybe we'll have some changes to it in the next year or so. It's a credit for employers who provide internships to college students in greater Minnesota. The terms of the credit as enacted, I think, proved to be more restrictive than employers were willing to participate in, so there are very few. I was at a meeting with the Department of Revenue staff last week or the week before, and currently, they have only identified about 10 returns that have claimed this credit. So that one is certainly one where you're using the tax system, which goes out to 2.5 million filers each year, to provide a benefit to a really small group of taxpayers. And that sort of leads me into the discussion of tax expenditures versus direct spending. One of the big advantages of tax expenditures perceived by legislators and others alike is that they don't have to be reauthorized every 2 years on the budget cycle. They, once they're enacted, typically they just remain in statute unless they're enacted with a sunset date, and that's it. Somebody has to go back and think about it and decide that they want to reduce it or they want to review it and maybe not allow that tax expenditure anymore, and that doesn't happen very often. A downside to a tax expenditure is that they're not always transparent to people. If you say that we're going to allow a $10,000 tax deduction for organ donation expenses or for being a health care preceptor, people hear $10,000 and they may think it's $10,000, but the tax value to them is really $10,000 multiplied by whatever their marginal rate is. So it's a lesser amount. So it's not transparent that way. Another thing about a tax expenditure is that there's a thing called the federal offset for people who itemize their deductions. And the way that works is that the federal income tax allows people, you choose between the standard deduction or itemized deductions. One of the itemized deductions is for state income tax paid. Taxpayers typically are going to choose whichever is larger, their itemized deductions or their standard deduction. Generally, those who itemize are people who are higher income, people who own their own home, because there are itemized deductions allowed for both property taxes and for mortgage interest. So the state income tax is part of that package of federal itemized deductions. Now, if there is a state tax credit or a state tax deduction that makes your state income tax smaller, you are then going to be deducting less state income tax at the federal level because you paid less in state income tax. So as a result of that, your federal income tax will increase by whatever your federal marginal rate is. So if you had someone, for instance, who had the $10,000 deduction and they're in the 7.85% bracket, which is not the top, but it's income over about $140,000 for a married couple, they're going to get a $785 state tax benefit for their deduction. But then when they do their federal tax, they're probably in the, they're maybe in the 35% federal bracket. They're going to immediately give 35% of that state tax benefit rate back to the federal government. So Minnesota is sort of spending $10,000, of which 65% is going to go to the intended target, which is the person who did whatever the thing was that we wanted to incentivize with our tax benefit, and then the rest of it gets sloughed off to the federal government. And an advantage of tax expenditures is that if you have a really big group of taxpayers who are eligible for it, you get some administrative efficiency by running the thing through the tax system. I think that's true of the working family credit, where there are, you know, we talked about the large number of people who claim it, over $300,000. The tax system is already in place. People are used to filing for that refund. And it works well to do that rather than setting up a separate administrative structure to, you know, to deliver those credits to people. So now over on the direct spending side, direct spending generally has to be reauthorized each budget cycle. That's not always the case. There are some spending items that have open and standing appropriations, but they're fairly rare. Direct spending is more transparent to the taxpayer. If you say you're going to give somebody a $10,000 grant, they think it's worth $10,000. Now it generally is. That's not entirely true, because that $10,000 payment, depending on who you're giving it to and what it's for, may be subject to tax. I think the healthcare preceptor thing, if you were giving a $10,000 grant to a healthcare preceptor, since they're not a student, it can't be cast as a scholarship and made into a tax-exempt thing that way. So they're going to have to declare that $10,000 as taxable income, both at the federal and state level, which is going to reduce the value to them by whatever their marginal rate is. Direct spending program can be more effective at delivering benefits to a small number of eligible claimants, particularly if it's a population of people that the state already knows something about who they are and has a way to do outreach to them other than through the tax system. So if you do it as a tax benefit, it's possible that people might simply miss it. They might not tell their tax preparer about it. They might not notice it when they go through the little questionnaire thing when they do TurboTax or TaxCut or whatever software they use. They might not pick up that there's a new form for it if they fill out their taxes themselves. But if it's a population you know something about, then the state might be able to reach them better with a grant program. So sort of to that, well, okay, I got one more, but then I'm going to talk a little bit about an existing thing that started out as a tax credit and became a direct spending program. So things that you all need to think about if you're going to propose a tax expenditure. And the most important thing is to try to frame what it is you're trying to accomplish with the tax expenditure, and if there really is a shortage of that thing that you're trying to get, if it's something that it makes sense for the state to be encouraging through the tax system. Then the next thing is to think about whether you want it to be a deduction or a credit, and if you want it to be a refundable credit or a non-refundable credit. So in that conversation policy discussion, you need to think about what population is going to be claiming this and how many of them there are going to be and so on. Then you need to think if you want to have it reward existing behavior. So there may be a lot of people already engaged in the behavior that you want, and when you enact this tax benefit, they would just stand to get a windfall from it because they're doing whatever this good thing is already. But now we're going to reward them for it, when what the state is really trying to accomplish is to get more people to do it. And sometimes, you know, there's a sense of fairness involved where you don't want to reward new people and not reward existing people. But that's something to think about, because everything that happens, whether it's a tax expenditure or a direct spending program, is going to be subject to budget constraints. So that's a consideration. Then the final thing, which I think that people who work with policy, tax policy and spending policy, would like to see more of, is to have some sort of plan at the outset for measuring whether or not you're accomplishing what your objective is for this thing. Some sort of way to tell if it's working. It's one thing to say that, okay, we're going to enact a tax deduction for organ donation expenses, and another thing to say, well, let's pay attention to the data for the next 10 years and see if we get more people being organ donors, because that's, you know, one of the things we're presumably trying to achieve with that. So in your case, you'd be looking at whether you really get more healthcare preceptors, you know, providing their time to developing healthcare professionals. So now, in 2014, there was a proposal. Actually, there's been proposals like this for many years in both bodies, but there was a proposal to provide a tax benefit, in this case a tax credit, to people who served as volunteer first responders for ambulances and for volunteer firefighter, volunteer firefighting, whatever they are, agencies. And they came forward and they wanted a $500 tax credit. This got into conference committee with the tax bill. At that time, there was a budget. You know, there's always a budget constraint. Everyone has their target for what their committee has. And the budget constraint on the tax committee was such that the conferees wanted to do something for this volunteer retention issue. It's a big problem making sure there's enough volunteer first responders, particularly in greater Minnesota. They didn't have enough money in their target to, they felt, fund the credit statewide. So what they enacted was instead a stipend that is paid to the volunteer agencies. The Department of Revenue administers this aid, and it pays it to municipalities where the firefighters and EMS organizations are located, and then they turn around and they provide stipends to the people who volunteered with them for all of the previous years. So they sort of piggybacked it on an existing delivery mechanism for state aid through the department and the municipalities. And that's in its first year of operation now. They also charge the state fire marshal, who is actually the administrator of this. The state fire marshal and the Department of Public Safety were very interested in doing it because they perceive there to be this shortage of volunteers in greater Minnesota. So they've delivered the first round of stipends to people just last month. And then there will be a report coming to the legislature in another couple of years on the 3 years of this pilot, not only in the counties where the pilot is going on, but in the counties, a selection of counties that are adjacent to them, to see whether there was an increase in the number of volunteers in the pilot area relative to the other areas, and to see if this program is achieving its objective. So this is one where the legislature chose not to go the tax expenditure route, but they did put something in law to try to see if this was really working to achieve the objective. So that's a thing for you all to consider going forward with whatever you decide to propose. And I think that is the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Manzi. Members, are there any questions at this time for Ms. Manzi? Or comments? Okay, we'll maybe keep you at the table, and I know Mr. Schoenbaum is going to kind of continue on this path with what a tax credit would look like and tax incentives in other states as it pertains to the challenge before the commission. So, Mr. Schoenbaum, if you want to continue, and I understand you have a presentation that's also in members' packets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we turn to the presentation, I'd ask you to pull out the bill that's in your packet, Senate File 1246. This was kind of the main Workforce Commission bill last session. The House and Senate versions were identical. And let's take a look at kind of what was proposed along these lines last year. It starts, it's section 4, it starts on page 7. So the route that this proposal took, and thank you, Ms. Manzi, that sets the stage perfectly, was as a direct expenditure rather than a credit or deduction through the tax system. If you turn to subdivision, well, if you look, actually, subdivision 2 lays out how the program would have worked. It would have been funds through the health department to sponsoring health professions, education institutions. Those institutions, in turn, would have made payments to eligible preceptors. Doesn't sound unfamiliar, unsimilar to the first responder program that was set up. Then you find in subdivision 3 who would have been eligible. There's an amount of teaching that preceptors must have done, and central to this is that only preceptors who were not already paid for being a preceptor by another source would have been eligible for this payment. As we look at Georgia, you'll see there are some similarities here. Further on, you'll see that the maximum award to a preceptor shall be $1,500. Again, as a direct payment, which far as we know would have been taxable income to the preceptor. I will say, even though we at the health department were involved in drafting this, it would have been clunky to administer. We tried to come up with the best method possible, making use of partners who are already used to dispersing funds for supporting health professions, education, and training. There would have been a fair amount of work involved in doing it. Let's take a look at what is actually happening in other states. And you'll see in this presentation, that there are examples both of a preceptor tax incentive from Georgia, and then in keeping with your commission recommendation to do both preceptor and rural-focused tax incentives. There are some rural examples from other states. Here's the list. Here's what Georgia has. They have a deduction that goes from $1,000 up to $10,000 in increments for the level, the amount of teaching that a preceptor does. The payments are to physicians only, I was struck that this also came as a recommendation from a statewide body, and they believe it's the first of its kind nationally. I was able so far to obtain various amounts of information from these other states. The questions that I was looking for answers to is, how long has the tax incentive been around? How many people take advantage of it on an annual basis? How much does it cost the state? And what's known about its effectiveness? I didn't find any of that yet for Georgia. I have calls in, multiple calls in, but I don't have those answers yet. The next examples are all rural. Oregon has a tax credit of up to $5,000 for this group of healthcare providers who agree to work in a rural area at least 20 hours a week. As you see, they also must agree to serve Medicare and Medicaid patients in at least the same proportion as the rest of their patient population. This has been around for over a decade. It's claimed by about 1,600 people a year. I was able to speak to the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which does the first eligibility determination for this credit. They actually certify 2,100 people on average each year as meeting those conditions. 1,600 of them on average claim. They don't know why the others don't. And you can see the annual cost to the state of Oregon is about $8.5 million. The revenue department there and the Office of Rural Health report that the program appears to have achieved its purpose. The Oregon legislature did commission a new study, a new program evaluation study of this credit, which will be completed in around 18 months. New Mexico has a similar rural health care tax credit. I think it's a somewhat smaller group of health care providers who are eligible. As you can see, there are two levels, up to 5,000 for that first list of providers, and 3,000 for those in that second grouping there. It's claimed by a much smaller group of individuals. Again, there is an intermediary, the Oregon Health Department, the New Mexico Health Department, that administers an application process, and there's quite a discrepancy between those that they certify as eligible. And what they do is they give people a form that they, I'm not sure if they keep it in their record or they submit it with their tax return. So they provide 2,000 of those, only 300 claim the credit, and the annual cost to the state of New Mexico is about $500,000. Louisiana also has a rural tax credit for physicians and dentists. One variable in the Louisiana tax credit that is not found elsewhere is that it's only available to any individual for 5 years. So they view it as a recruiting incentive. You can see the conditions for physicians and dentists. Again, the provider must accept Medicaid and Medicare. And if they don't continue to meet those conditions, the money is recaptured by the state of Louisiana. That's what I was able to find so far. I think it's interesting food for thought. I will continue to seek some of those details about size of these programs in participants and cost and anything that's known about their effectiveness and report back to you if I have better luck between now and our future meetings.
And I just have a brief question, and then Ms. Manzi, and I don't know which one of you would be able to answer this, and then also I just wanted to put out a heads up. If there's any provider groups or anyone in the audience who represents providers that would have any insight into this issue of a preceptor tax credit, I know Senator Klassen and I and the members on the table would be interesting just to hear any input to things that you think are blocking this, or maybe if there's the right number, high or low, if this truly is something that would incentivize people. If there is anyone that would want to provide input, I'll maybe just open it up in a few minutes. We'd love to hear from you. If not today and you want to send an email or any input, that would be helpful, because obviously we want to know if we're hitting the mark and kind of the trigger point that would help us with the work on this commission. And I guess my question maybe to you, Ms. Manzi, is as you look at some of these states, for instance, Oregon has the $5,000 tax credit, and it seems as though, you know, that has achieved some of their purposes by attracting more people. Is there any way of comparing what a $5,000 tax credit, how that compares to a $1,500 direct appropriation or the grant that we would have in our bill in terms of, are those pretty far apart in terms of the incentive mark and what the actual take-home amount would be that one of these preceptors would see? Is there any way that you could give kind of an apples-to-apples comparison to relate those two?
Madam Chair, sure. A credit is going to directly offset liability. Before I get into comparing that $5,000 to the $1,500, I wanted to share speculation about Oregon and New Mexico's program, which I can follow up on for you. You see that the data Mr. Schoenbaum found, there were 2,100 people eligible for the Oregon credit, but 1,600 who claimed it. In New Mexico, they had about 2,000 people eligible and 300 who claimed it. And my suspicion is that both of those credits are non-refundable credits. Now, if you look at who's eligible for those two credits, it includes a lot of health professionals, some of whom are more highly compensated than others. So there may be some lower and moderate income health professionals who are eligible for the credits in New Mexico and Oregon, but who may be eligible for other credits that those two states offer or other tax benefits, so that by the time they go to apply this particular credit against their liability, they find that they don't have any liability left. So they've gone through and they've applied, you know, for this credit. They've been certified as eligible. And then when they go to claim it, they find that it doesn't really provide them with any benefit. And that gets back to the transparency issue that I raised with regard to a tax benefit. Now, that would be the case only if these credits were non-refundable, and that's something I can go check on and then communicate to the commission. Now, as far as the relative size of the benefit from a $5,000 credit and a $1,500 grant payment, the $5,000 credit, assuming you have $5,000 of liability, is going to reduce your state liability by $5,000. So it's going to be worth $5,000 to you at the state level. It's then going to have a federal offset if you're an itemizer, where your federal income tax will go up because your state income tax deduction is less. So you lose part of the benefit of that $5,000 credit that you got. Now, the $1,500 payment, that's going to have to be reported as taxable income both federally and at the state level. So you're going to lose part of that as well, and how much you lose will depend on what federal and state brackets you're in. So it's sort of I guess my initial reaction to that would be, well, $5,000 is quite a bit more than $1,500. So all other things being equal, and assuming that the person has $5,000 of state tax liability, which is quite a bit of state tax liability, the $5,000 is worth more. But, you know, for some people, depending on what their other deductions were and how much taxable income they had, the $1,500 might be worth more. It just will depend.
So it's a very dynamic situation, is what I mean, what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's different for different people. And that's, you know, and it's much more transparent with the tax credit, because there it's $5,000 off of your tax liability. It gets less transparent with a tax deduction, where it's a certain amount off of your taxable income, and then you have to apply the marginal rate, and then you have to go through the federal offset thing. So by the time you're all done, a $10,000 deduction is maybe reduced to $500 or $600 of actual benefit to the individual, which is, that's a lot different.
Senator Benson.
Yes.
Madam Chair, are we limiting this to a preceptor conversation, or are we also talking about rural health incentives? Because we seem to have both in our packet. And I'm wondering what our overall objective is by offering the tax credits. Is it just to get more preceptors, or is it to increase access in areas where we might not have enough providers? So it might help us focus if we pick one. But that's a policy decision. And so right now I don't know which way to go with decision making. Are we going to do preceptors and invest money there, or are we going to look more broadly, or do we need to do both? I feel like we're a little unstructured.
No, I appreciate that, Senator Benson. My impression coming into this conversation and what we've been talking about here has related more directly to preceptors. However, I do think you raise a good point in terms of, with, you know, budget restrictions and finite resources, you know, it's always going to be the challenge of prioritizing. And I think that's something that this commission is tasked with in terms of deciding. And I think as co-chair, Senator Klass maybe had something you wanted to add to that on your thoughts. But I do think both are big challenges when we look at the workforce pipeline. And I do think that coming out of the recommendations of this commission, there will have to be a priority given to how these issues fall and where we think they need to go. Senator Benson, to that
Madam
point.
Chair, I don't want to step in front of Senator Claussen if you had a comment. I had a bill, actually, I had a revenue note drafted because I got a hearing in tax committee, and it wasn't included in the Senate tax bill because the number wasn't big enough. But it was a deduction for charity care in federally qualified health centers and in rural critical access facilities. So $600,000 a year up to $700,000 a year, which is a fairly small number relative to the population we're trying to incent. But there are reforms that needed to complement that, for example, liability insurance. And but anyway, that those deductions would come in the form of the equivalent of a 1099 from the organizations. You had to volunteer 120 hours a year in order to meet the threshold. Obviously, we could lower that threshold. We could adjust facilities that were eligible, but as we moved forward, the Department of Revenue would have been happy to revise the note, except we had no evidence of the amount of volunteering that was already happening, because people aren't volunteering because they have to carry separate liability insurance or malpractice insurance, my apologies. And so there are things that we can do, but if we have a direction, I can certainly take on work to do a piece of this, because I have some pieces started already. We had a hearing in the Human Services Committee in the Senate. So happy to contribute these things going forward. But if we're just doing preceptors, I have nothing additional.
Senator Claussen.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. I think last year we tried to address the workforce shortage in outstate Minnesota through loan forgiveness, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be open to looking at all options. I think we need to look at loan forgiveness and see the effectiveness. One of the follow-ups we need to do is to study that and see, are we getting our bang for our buck by doing that? But I think last year we looked at the preceptor situation. We did have discussions with the tax chairs who generally do not look positive on tax credits or tax reductions. So we went a different direction with the Senate File 1246 and looking at a compensation for preceptors. But I think as we review our study of this, I think we need to be open in looking at all options because we do know that we have a crisis out in rural mm-hmm. Minnesota for health care.
And Senator Ben.
If I may, Madam Chair and Senator Claussen, with loan forgiveness, you're trying to grow new healthcare professionals. With some sort of tax incentive, you take existing workforce and give them other opportunity. And as our baby boomers age and we lose that end of the population, perhaps there's a licensed dentist who would like to volunteer a couple days a week. And so thinking differently about how we access workforce as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible. I know we have a lot of talent that we're trying to grow, but we also have talent that we don't want to lose. And so looking at both ends of the workforce spectrum, I think, is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schoenbaum, I'm going to ask two questions of you, one relating to Senator Benson. Do we have other programs that assist practicing health care workers in the state who may not be interested in loan forgiveness? That's question number one. It seems to me we had a discussion about this last year that perhaps there are other incentives for practicing physicians and others, that they receive assistance in some other form. And then secondly, in all of the other states that we're looking at, they must accept Medicare and Medicaid. And I know that's important, but I also know that through discussions last year, in particularly the area of dentistry, there were dentists that were choosing not to access some state programs because of that provision. So perhaps you could comment on those two questions or thoughts.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Claussen. I think the first question may have a more straightforward answer. The discussion we're having at the moment about tax incentives, preceptor grants, and loan forgiveness is captured so far incentives directed at individuals, at individual people. And I'll Madam Chair, if you see, I'm going to use my phone a friend here. If you see any hands in the audience, please call them up here. But I can't think of any other state incentive directed at individuals. The health department and occasionally other agencies have a variety of competitive grant programs directed at organizations, at clinics, hospitals, other healthcare facilities to establish or improve facilities in rural areas, inner city areas, other areas of need. So those are out there. A new program, kind of directed at individuals, just comes to mind, that complements another existing program is the existing nursing facility scholarship program and the new home and community-based services scholarship program that the legislature created last year. Those aren't incentives to move people kind of physically from one place to another. but they are support for people advancing their careers in the field where they've begun their work. Do you see any hands, Madam Chair?
Not at this point, but I will keep you posted. Senator Claussen.
Yes, Mr. Schoenbaum, thanks for jarring my memory. You're exactly right. We talked about institutions or clinics that we had some facility grants, and that's what I was thinking of in that question. So thank you. And the second part.
To your second question, Senator Claussen, the issue of Medicaid payment and access to dental services for Medicaid enrollees is a longstanding and often discussed one. I can't claim to be an expert on it. I think I did see a representative of a major dental provider in the audience. There may be others. I think I think one agreed fact is that Medicaid patients access dental services at a much less frequent rate than the population at large. The causes of that discrepancy, I think you can find numerous positions on. I think there has been action, certainly before the Health and Human Services committees of various types to address that, to improve that discrepancy over the years. I'll stop there, and again, if you see any hands, Madam Chair, you might want to call somebody who's more fluent in this issue to the table.
Well, and I'll just Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I have as we look to other states is there any analysis out there regarding tax savings that may come from success? In particular, Oregon seems to have made a statement that they feel like they've been successful in bringing more providers to rural communities. So have they been able to realize any type of health care savings if people are getting care for chronic illnesses that are being managed as opposed to being treated in emergency rooms? Is there any savings for hospitals in terms of uncompensated care if they're seeing Medicaid patients showing up in emergency rooms or uninsured patients showing up in emergency rooms? So is there analysis on that side of potential for savings in the healthcare system?
I'm sure.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Representative Halverson, the information on the effects of these credits and deductions that I've been able to find so far has been acknowledged as anecdotal even by the people in Oregon. And the policy goal that the programs are directed at least explicitly, is recruitment and retention and improved distribution of healthcare providers in their states. So I'm not aware that anyone has looked at kind of those related issues that you're asking about. As I mentioned, Oregon, is beginning a new evaluation study. I'll find out what the design of that study is and report back whether it will look at any of the related impacts that you're asking about.
And I think one thing we had talked about, Mr. Schoenbaum, along with Senator Claussen, was trying to get a handle on if we're, for instance, just on the issue of preceptors in this challenge. And I think one thing that legislators have to grapple with is trying to get an understanding of the problem. And my understanding is that we don't have a ton of information at this point on in terms of how many preceptors we have and how many preceptors we need and how big of a spread that is. Is that correct, Mr. Schoenbaum?
Madam Chair, we know some. We had a back of the envelope conversation, because virtually all health professions education requires some clinical training component, every health profession student, you know, needs a preceptor at some point. And that turns into a big number. That's about as far as we got. There was, a fair amount of testimony before the commission last year on the struggles that health professions education institutions are encountering finding new and retaining current preceptors and the issues that they report they are starting to see is people dropping out of precepting and being harder to replace because of the workload demands on their schedules. They report employers who used to sponsor their employees to precept starting to ask for payment for precepting services that had not been a part of the picture in the past. Some educational institutions beginning to offer payment for precepting and putting others for whom that would be a budget problem at a disadvantage. So we have pieces of the picture. I think we reached a clear conclusion that it is a problem, but I think something we talked about working on this year in the commission is trying to get a more precise handle on the numbers.
Thank you for that, and I think that it does raise a lot of interesting questions, and even in the conversation of a grant or the financial incentive, I think from some of the conversations that I remember in the past, the trigger point isn't necessarily always just going to be financial for some of these folks who are later in their careers and they're living a fine life with what they make. A $1,500 grant might not be the trigger. It's their time is much more valuable, and just what it takes to engage in a preceptor program, or the pressures just from getting through a day in the clinic and seeing all the patients that are needed. There's not time to be training someone in addition to the demands of patient load and everything else. And so I think one of the tasks of the commission is to kind of have a discussion, and certainly we will need input from folks in the audience and the people out there. Is the financial incentive the right incentive? Is it going to be, and if so, how big is it, and then can the state afford that? I mean, it's kind of a multi-pronged question, but I think it's safe to say that it's safe to say that simply a financial piece is not the only thing that's holding somebody up from engaging in this preceptor program, as you just laid out very clearly for us, Mr. Schoenbaum, that there's a handful of obstacles from both the possibly the provider and the employer, in addition to time and just constraints in the healthcare system in general, that's creating a challenge for folks to engage in this program. But it is a key component to getting medical students trained and out into the field, and so it really is a challenge to be dealt with. Are there any other comments? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a couple points. One is I think timing is really important. So the medical school on the Duluth campus, they focus on training physicians that will go practice in rural areas. And what the obstacles there are is the constraints on teaching resources to increase the capacity for that program, to increase the number of student slots available. And the other problem they're running into is finding preceptors who are willing to work with students, because that cost was absorbed by the institution, the organization, and they received some federal money, but that money's no longer, a lot of that money is no longer available, and they're asking the educational institutions to pay for these training programs, and they don't have funds. So I think that's the most successful programs are ones that identify students who are interested in working in rural areas, training those students, and getting students in the rural area to do preceptor and do residency programs. So I think we want to look at where we've been successful in the past in that program, and on the Duluth campus has been really successful, and so maybe we should invest more in those types of programs. Whereas if you put money into reimbursing providers directly, that's once they're already located in that rural area, they're going to apply for that tax credit. So I think we have to think about timing and when do we get the biggest impact, and I think it's going to be earlier rather than later. So investing up front on those training programs and increasing the number of slots and investing in programs that have been successful at placing and retaining physicians in rural areas.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excellent points, Representative Schultz. This is starting to sound like perhaps a panel at a future meeting. I think great idea to talk about both kind of the challenges and successes that we can learn for, and as we've just been discussing, kind of those intervention points. You know, there's the individual, there's the educational institution, there's the employer. I'm sure they will all bring us different perspectives on where the best point is, but sounds like could be a fruitful conversation.
Absolutely, and I'll just open it up. Is there anyone in the audience today who would like to kind of speak to this issue, obstacles, wins of the preceptor program? If you just want to come forward, and we'll keep it fairly brief. We have one more presentation today, but we do want to give an opportunity. If there's any insights that you think would be helpful for us to hear, we'd love to hear that. Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you. I'm Juliana Milhofer with the Minnesota Medical Association. You asked for provider input before, so I want to just give a brief statement. So provider incentives for physicians are very important to us. We've been studying the clinical training site issue for about a year and a half now, and we know that there's a time issue and resource issue, but incentives are important, either while they're recruiting preceptors or during the entire work of the preceptor throughout the many years that they do precept. Whether it's a tax incentive, a credit, or an expenditure, we don't know what's the trigger point, like you mentioned before, what would that number be, but we know that some type of incentive would help recruit preceptors and maintain them in their work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have a question. Senator Benson.
Yep.
Thank you. Remind me your name.
Juliana Milhofer.
Juliana, thank you. Are there other things that physicians have to do to maintain their license, continuing professional education, and so forth? Can you help me understand that world a little bit?
So for the
Ms. Milhofer.
Precept? Thank you.
No, to just have a license beyond graduate, pass your board.
Correct. So physicians who have CME, so continuing medical education credits that they have to maintain throughout their careers as physicians.
Okay.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've forgotten my session manners. Does preceptor time count as continuing medical education?
Ms. Milhofer.
Madam Chair, thank you. I know that there are some institutions that do offer training for preceptors and they count it as CME credits, but not all of them do that. I don't think that's a standard practice, and that could be something that could be looked at, whether incentivizing preceptors through CME credits would be of value.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, because in licensed professionals, it's becoming increasingly important to develop mentor relationships, and many of the licensing professions, the instructors are given continuing professional education credits for being instructors because it takes time to become that proficient, and it does take extra time, but it also values mentoring. And so we might be stepping outside of necessarily the purview of this committee, but the Board of Medical Practice might look at some CMEs to be given to preceptors. So it doesn't just have to be the state writing a check or providing a tax credit, but acknowledging their professional participation. Madam Chair, I don't know how many credits are required for CME annually or in a three-year cycle, but maybe there's a material amount that would nudge somebody over that line, or at least say, as a profession, we value preceptors in a very direct way.
I think that's a great point. Ms. Milhofer, any comment to that?
Madam Chair, thank you. I know that for different positions, it's different. It's money matters more to them. Others, a CME credit would matter to them. I think it depends on. It's a very individualized, I think, incentive. If that works for some, it might work, and for others, that might not work as much as a financial incentive. Mm-hmm. And some others, they just want more time to precept. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just have a question. Thank you for testifying. So if a physician wants to be a preceptor, but they're employed at a larger healthcare system or a larger clinic, do they need approval by that organization to become a preceptor and formally engage in that process?
I believe they...
Ms. Milhofer.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I believe that they do need, not permission, but there's clinical training sites for each system are differently. The way they're created is different for each system, but they have a set role. So if you have a clinic, for example, the Cook Clinic in Minneapolis, for example, would have, you know, a certain number of preceptors there, and they would be, you know... The system itself would know how many preceptors and how many of those sites are. So they would have a certain position in the role of that preceptor.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we also need to get organizations, provide them incentives to be willing to be involved in this preceptor program and then get them to enroll some of their employees if they're salaried physicians. Thank you.
Ms. Milhofer.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We need the support of everyone so you know that if you're precepting at a certain system, a certain clinic, that you have the support of your entire system to take on that role. Because it is a time issue. It's how many patients you're seeing. And for physicians, it's a very tough world to be in, you know, with especially family practice physicians, I believe so.
Thank you. And with the shortage of family practice practitioners, that kind of compounds the problem, certainly. So thank you for that insight. Members, any other questions? Thank you so much for being willing to come forward and testify. We really appreciate it. Is there anyone else who at this time wants to just provide some insight on this issue? Otherwise, you're, of course, welcome to at any time. So with that, we will move on to the final item on our agenda, and that is we're going to be hearing from Liz Beal. If you want to come forward. And Mr. Schoenbaum, I didn't know if you wanted to cue this up for us at all in kind of the direction we're going in now, Mr. Schoenbaum.
Sure, Madam Chair, just briefly. Last year, those of you who were on the commission will recall that you heard about a case where I believe it was a nurse practitioner student was in a program that required her to find her own clinical placement. The report was that the school did not do that for its students, and that in the case you heard about, one of the results of that was that the student wasn't able to find a placement soon enough to graduate on time and lost a year. So you expressed an interest in revisiting the issue. We've done as staff some research on it. After Ms. Beal finishes, if there's time, I can tell you what I've found so far in terms of the mental health training programs. It's been a hard issue to get one's arms around. So kind of after the discussion today, I think we could probably use some direction on kind of whether and where you want to go from today. I was fortunate enough calling around to find out that Ms. Beal, who's worked for many years for Health Force Minnesota and for the statewide clinical collaboration partnership that involves both MinSCU, the university, and private colleges, knows something about this subject. And she stepped up and sent out a survey and is here to tell us what she's found so far.
Thank you for that context. That's very helpful, Mr. Schoenbaum. Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Elizabeth Beal. Excuse me. I'm executive director of the Clinical Coordination Partnership. We're a membership-funded entity that's housed under the umbrella of Health Force Minnesota, which is underneath Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We've been in existence for approximately 10 years. When we began underneath to address the clinical shortages within registered nursing, pre-licensure nursing. Right now, we serve 64 different clinical sites and 48 different pre-licensure nursing programs, U of M, MinSCU, proprietary, and private. Basically, what we did is we realized that there were so many inefficiencies and lack of information and everybody having different ways of doing things that we worked to standardize the methodologies of how clinical placements were placed and also standardize the data language. We were able to increase efficiencies and therefore increase the likelihood that a clinical partner would say yes to a school requesting for placements. Because of our success within registered nursing, our members recommended that we expand into the advanced practice professional environment, which is nurse practitioners and physician assistants, to try to take the lessons learned to that environment. We do have a working relationship with all of our Minnesota PA and NP programs, plus major healthcare systems. We're working right now to revamp the process of how requests are made and accommodating and so forth. And also we built a software application which really makes it apples to apples to all the schools requesting information in one place so it's easy to access for the clinical partners so they can make their decisions. That's a little bit of a background. Just to give some components of what these clinicals are for APP, Advanced Practice Professionals, is when you're looking at a physician assistant student, they typically do about 11 separate experiences. So if you're thinking about that, one student needs 11 clinicals. Some of them can be done by the same preceptor. Some of them have to be different. Within physician assistants, sometimes they're 8 weeks, 4 weeks, 2 weeks. They're tied up like in women's health, cardiology, oncology, so forth. For a nurse practitioner, it's usually considered more within hours. They usually go within 1,000 to 1,200 clinical hours, and they usually do that within different clumps of time, such as 240 hours, 300 hours, and so forth. And again, that could be done by different preceptors at different facilities, or one preceptor could do longer amounts of time. There are some nurse practitioner programs, such as nurse anesthetist, that would require additional time, such as 240 hours additional just for that specialty. So we did a survey to our schools, and the schools we asked were the Minnesota programs, and you can see we have the physician-assisted schools. There's three within Minnesota, and then nurse practitioner schools, about seven. And the questions, we did this in short notice. All of this was put together within 2 weeks. But the questions that we ask them is, number one, does your program have a policy to find the clinical placements for your students? Two, does your school have a policy of that the student's responsible for finding the placement? And three, if there's an alternate way that you do this. If you flip the page over of this handout that is in your packets, the responses I got were phone calls, emails, and so forth, so I tried to package this into what the majority of the responses were. For the I'll first go into the physician assistant schools, and this applies to all three programs. It's because of accreditation guidelines that within their accreditation guidelines, the PA schools must find the placement for their students. So they do have a set policy. For nurse practitioner schools, it's a little bit different. There's no set policy, but different schools, depending on the length of time they've been working or how large they are, do this in different ways. For instance, the University of Minnesota and College of St. Catharines both have staff that place students in clinicals for them. Now, Minnesota State University Mankato and Winona State, and actually Metropolitan State and St. Scholastica, also work to try to help find placements for students, but they also expect the student to also help try to find their own placement too. So it's kind of working in both ways. They tag team the effort. The bullets underneath the second major bullet is the feedback that I received from the schools, just kind of summarizing how they typically find the placement. For instance, they ask the student where they'd like to go. and they get requests submitted by the clinical coordinator. A lot of our programs, since we do work with the major healthcare systems and we do have a software application for training, not all the healthcare systems in the state work with this, but if the school is making a request to a clinical site that works within our network, then they would submit that request via our online software and the clinical coordinator would access that and make the decision. For other places that aren't in our network, the school would have to call either the organization or staff within that healthcare provider area. And the only school I did not hear feedback from was the Bethel Midwife Program. Now, these are the Minnesota programs, but we do know that a lot of Minnesota students are being trained from outside online programs. And those programs typically have the student call to find a placement on their own. And I know that just anecdotally that that's a very hard environment. I live around the Rochester Mayo area, and I know a lot of nurse practitioners that have had to go to Iowa and so forth just to get their clinical experiences.
Okay, thank you for taking the time to be here. Members, are there any questions or comments for the testifier? Our Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this affect their accreditation in any way if they don't help students find placements?
Within the nurse practitioner world, no. I do not believe so.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you receive any feedback from the advanced nurse practitioner schools as to why they don't play a greater part in placement?
Well, Ms. Beal.
Thank you. Sorry. A lot of the nurse practitioners are newer, so they're figuring out the process of best accommodating students. They've recognized that some schools do this and some schools don't. Sometimes it's just due to the amount of staff that they have in their program. So there's no set reason why for all of these programs. It's kind of how they've started.
Any other questions, members? And I know that this challenge, we spoke about this with Mr. Schoenbaum, is this highlights kind of one area of health professions where this is a challenge, but it's certainly a challenge across the board when it comes to medical students, healthcare students of any kind, trying to find locations and training sites. And so it's certainly a big task to be dealt with. Senator Klassen.
Yeah, thank you. If the legislature were to take action on this, saying that all licensed facilities must provide placement, what would be the impact on the schools? And what would be your opinion of that?
Ms. Beal.
Without asking a few questions of the folks that would be directly impacted, that's hard for me to answer. Off the cuff, it would seem like that would help the environment, but then I know that there's probably other issues that we'd really have to ask the right questions and really analyze the environment beforehand so that inadvertent issues don't arise. What I do know is it never seems that one thing's an easy answer. We've got to look at the entire picture in order to make things that really work.
And to that point, Ms. Bill, I think that's an insightful response, particularly when you'd think that many of these institutions, as they are preparing medical students, nurses, whatever it might be, it bodes well for them if their graduates are then being placed and working in their professions, graduation rates, their students aren't having to drop out because they can't fulfill their training requirements. So you'd think that there'd be a lot of built-in incentives for them to aid their students in having access to this, which is why it seems to be a bit of a head-scratcher as to why there's, in some cases, you know, there's programs put in place to help students, but in others, they're really left out on their own to kind of figure this out when you'd think and hope that the institutions have a great network with the providers all across the state, relationships, that seems to be lacking. So certainly something for conversation. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not on the higher ed committee, so somebody could help me. I don't think we license colleges. I think they're accredited
And I don't think the state does that. I think there are regional entities, and obviously we can, you know, incent MNSCU, and we can politely request the University of Minnesota, but the University of St. Catherine or St. Mary's are regionally accredited or nationally accredited, and so I think we need to have a better understanding of how they come to have accreditation. It sounds like some physician assistant schools, part of their accreditation is to do this. And so I would be hesitant to say, as a condition of being in the state of Minnesota, you must do this. I'd like to understand the environment before we go forward.
I think that's an important point. Is there any other questions or comments? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment. You know, I work at a higher education institution, and we require internships of our students. And it takes staff to work on identifying placements, and you have to work with the Office of the General Counsel to work on liability issues and contracting and have placement agreements there. And so I think what we could do as a legislature is make sure we're funding institutions of higher education so they can have the staff available to make sure that there are placements for students available. So that would be one option, at least for MNSCU and the University of Minnesota school systems.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Madam Chair, if I may, one point for the future, and then I can give a quick report on what I found out about psychology. I don't have a precise handle on the relationship between higher education institutions and the state either, but I think there is some relationship in addition to accreditation by an accrediting organization. But I'll ask the question of the Office of Higher Education. That's the governing state agency, and bring the answer back for you. Regarding the mental health occupations, I did a preliminary inquiry, didn't get that far in the mental health occupations. I learned, similar to what Ms. Beal reports, that in the field of psychology at the PhD level, there is an accrediting standard that requires PhD psychology programs to document, I think the term is something like satisfactory progress of their students toward graduation. That serves as a de facto requirement that the PhD programs get placements for their students. At the master's level, my inquiries are early, but there appears to be a similar variation that Ms. Beal reported with nurse practitioners, with a range of involvement among master's level and psychology programs, from deep involvement to little. And I'll keep on that if the commission is interested, and bring more information as I find it.
Okay, members, I don't see any further questions at this time. Thank you, Ms. Beal, for taking the time to be here. We appreciate it. And members, with that, that is today's agenda. I'll just briefly go back and just see if there's any comment, concerns regarding the draft work plan that was in front of you. If anyone has any immediate comments right now. Otherwise, you know, feel free to email or call with any comments. Senator Wicklund.
Just a question. Will some aspect of this preceptor discussion be added to a later meeting where we can have more data presented, or, you know, receive more data so we can possibly make a better decision about, you know, whether we want to include it as a recommendation?
I can turn to you, Mr. Schoenbaum, also, but my understanding is there was a presenter that we were hoping to have to kind of speak to this issue that we addressed today that we're hoping to bring to another meeting. So I would foresee this being something that we circle back on. Senator Claussen and I, I'm sure, will discuss that. Would
would be open. I think a lot of the discussion today raises a lot more questions about, you know, how we can most adequately address the challenge. So I think that will certainly be the case. Anything else? Okay, not seeing any members. The next meeting will be on September 17th, same time. More or less the same location, maybe just with a room switch. But thank you for your time in being here. And this meeting is adjourned.